Just getting back from Impressions Long Beach, an awesome show this year. We did an incredible interview. We finally got the Riley Hawkins. So many of us had started on a Riley Hawkins before, and we spoke to the Riley Hawkins who manufactured these. He's been on such an incredible journey manufacturing these presses for such a long time. We talk about that. We talk about his passions in building cars and racing cars and what he is up to today. He is still innovating. Really excited for this episode, but real quick, we've got a couple sponsors that help put on the show every single week.
If you need a solution to improve efficiency and reduce costs in your art department, you can hit up GraphicSource. GraphicSource offers industry-leading outsource options for truly becoming a part of your team. They plug and play with Printavo and other shop management softwares. And if it comes to steps, mockups, creative art, order management, embroidery, digitizing, back office admin, there's no better company in our industry to work with. They have over 40 years in the game and a proven track record of success. Hit them up and you'll get 50% off your first vector, step, or embroidery order. Thanks so much, GraphicSource. All right, EasyWay. Spending hours cleaning screens is a thing of the past. With EasyWay's screen printing and screen cleaning chemicals, their innovative formulas are designed to work quickly and effectively so you can spend less time cleaning and more time creating. Plus, EasyWay is passionate about empowering printers of all skill levels. They offer helpful resources and expert advice to help you succeed in screen printing. Thank you so much, EasyWay, for sponsoring the podcast. And if you haven't heard of Multicraft underscore daddy, go to Instagram right now, type in Multicraft underscore daddy. And if you need ink supplies or a daddy, Multicraft screen printing and digital supplies for over 50 years has been providing you with top brands at competitive prices. You can mention the Printavo podcast and receive an extra 10% off your first order. Dave at Multicraft wants to sweeten it up. And so every episode you can DM him and he is giving away PMI tape. So if you haven't already DM'd him, shoot him a message. He picks a winner every single week, and we appreciate you. All right, DGI Apparel. I'm here to tell you about the best new software platform to hit the industry. It's called DGI Apparel, and it was built by a group of super smart MIT engineers with a background in screen printing. It allows you to connect your accounts with Sanmar, Alpha Rotor, SNS, AS Color. You can even buy PMI tape on there, and you can compare prices, inventory, shipping times, across every apparel supplier on one website. You don't need multiple screens. You can literally just go to dgiapparel.com and all of them will pop up. The average shop spends 2 hours purchasing every day and DGI is going to cut that time in half. So ask yourself, what would you do with an extra hour every single day? And we don't have a promo code because DGI is free and it's always going to be free. That's right. It costs you $0. So if you're not already using DGI, you're wasting your time and money. Sign up today at dgiapparel.com. Join 1,500 other shops that are saving time and money on their purchases. All right, BMAC. BMAC is one of the best dryers in the DTF space. They are a leader in innovative solutions for DTF printing. They manufacture these printers here in the United States. They're dedicated to providing top-of-the-line equipment and technology that enhance productivity and quality with a commitment to excellence. BMAC Industries continues to push boundaries of what's possible in garment decoration. I work super closely with DTF Superstore and the team over there, and this dryer is great. We just got ours just a couple of months ago, and they are fantastic. So hit up DTF Superstore for all of your DTF needs, and let's get to the podcast.
What is this, by the way? You're carrying this when we...
Well, this is a car I designed... I built a previous shorter wheelbase car that had a Ford V8 in it, but I always liked 12 cylinders. So this has
12 cylinder car.
Yeah. Holy cow. Well, like Ferraris and Lambos and that sort of stuff. Well, so this has two 250 cubic inch Ford straight sixes that are bolted together in the middle. Mm-hmm. The rear is, the timing is 30 degrees off. So you have 12 individual exhaust pulses. So it sounds just like a Ferrari. So, but it's a 500 cubic inch V12 or a 12 cylinder.
So what does this mean? You build this now?
From scratch, yeah. This is my design. So the entire car, everything on it, will build to my design.
This looks like a Batmobile from the top.
Yeah. But this should be about 2,800 pounds, something like that. And it'll have... probably 450 to 500 horsepower.
Have you built other cars before then?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, race cars, street cars, that's right. But all from scratch.
From collecting, or you sell them, or what?
I sell what I can sell to fuel the next project. So this one here, the objective is to raise funds for the vocational school. So I'm going to donate the finished car to Rancho Cielo. We should be able to sell this for $400,000 or $500,000 at the Pebble Beach Concourse Week, because it's for a nonprofit. So a lot of the Silicon Valley guys have too much money anyway. So the funds would go back to Rancho.
Wow.
Yeah. Which I want to get to the nonprofit too, but really quick, just on the car. So sorry, you're building this from scratch?
Yeah. Yeah, off of these plans. Yeah, we'll
understand that. Is it just me that I'm like, where do you start?
Pipes?
All right, we have, yeah.
Well, you start, start with a bar napkin.
Okay.
Check.
That's what I'm famous for.
You start with a bar napkin.
Then maybe
a couple
chassis?
Drinks and some ideas.
Right. Yep.
Then what?
Well, you just have at it. I usually use a quarter square blue grid network. So when you're drawn, you're starting to be proportionally correct.
And you do it all by hand first on paper.
Yeah. And then part of this will also be for the vocational side to work on a CAD program to design this whole thing in CAD. And then that can go over to 3D printing, which we're going to have some 3D printed parts in here. And then also it goes straight over to CNC machining for any of the machining we have to do on this. So it gives three new areas of vocational training for the school that they don't have currently, but that they want.
So you're, the garage that you're building this in, that's in the Salinas?
That's in the vocational facility. And they're they already have about a $20 million facility there, and they're going to build a brand new facility to do automotive restoration work. And America's only four-year university is in McPherson, Kansas, just about 45 minutes north of Wichita. And they have a four-year automotive restoration program there. It's the only one in the country. And we're working on making Rancho Cielo kind of a prep school, because we're going to get their same curriculum in so we can train everybody the way they do it. And then there's scholarship money and more if this thing sells correctly, to where we can send some of the top students to McPherson College to undergo their automotive restoration. And those guys are the best in the world. They're collectors from all over the world vie for their best students.
Mm. Wow.
So it's really a nice opportunity kind of out of left field.
That's really cool. I was reading a little bit up on the internet about you.
Uh-oh.
There's
it must be true, right?
I hope it's true. And maybe this will segue of how, you know, you got into the screen printing industry, but there's a story about you driving an Aston Martin and taking it up to 8,000 RPM.
Oh, yeah.
Can you tell us a little bit about that? And
where are you, James Bond?
How this has, it seemed like a pretty important story. I'd love to hear a little bit about your background. And
quick break. Why? Because we have an awesome announcement. DTF Expo is right around the corner. We've got Adrian from DTFExpo.com just to tell a few things about it and why you should be there.
Yes, thanks, Bruce. DTF Expo is happening April 1st through 2nd in Mesa, Arizona at the Mesa Convention Center. We have 2 days of education sessions, a full trade show floor, all DTF specific. And also we have a pre-expo workshop happening the day before the shows. So lots of education, lots of opportunities for you to buy, network, and talk all things DTF.
And Stephen Farag is talking. I heard he gave an incredible talk last year. He's doing it again, something brand new.
Yep.
Plus, Kevin Baumgart, incredible sales coaching, is going to be there as well. What are you talking about?
Well, I'm talking about something really great. Let me tell you about it. It's going to be on...
I can't wait to find out.
Wednesday, April 2nd.
Yep.
The title is DTF Doomsday.
Whoa.
And so we're going to be learning about the big, ugly facts and truths about DTF in your business and some of the mistakes we've made so that, you know, if DTF Doomsday ever comes, you're ready for it.
DTFExpo.com. Back to the show.
Well, I grew up in Japan about 20 miles outside west of Tokyo, and as a kid, and I came back to the States to start high school. And while we were over there, my dad bought this X-Factory team Aston Martin race car, one of 10. And it was actually 10 built, but it was one of the three team cars. And my dad always told me that I could drive the car when I was 16. And somehow that didn't happen. And so I was 17 and I was gonna go into the Navy to be an air crew guy and some anti-submarine stuff, but in the reserves so that I could still race. And anyway, here's this Aston Martin. And I'm going, damn it, I'm gonna drive this car. And it was a 6-cylinder engine, which was just magic. We had these really nice big 3-inch megaphones on the side that came right out. It was right-hand drive and came right out underneath your ear, which is why I've got hearing aids. But at any rate, I warmed the thing up in the garage, put 5 gallons of fuel in it, went up on the highway, and I wanted to see if I could top end it, which was $8,000 in top gear, which figured out to be about 160 miles an hour. Wow. And I just wanted to know if I had the guts to do it. And so I took off, and my my throttle foot was bouncing so hard, I had to lock my knee in place and just, you know, keep pushing down there. And I got it up to $8,000. So I hit 160 before I was getting ready to crash from running out of road. But that told me that I could do it. So I started racing when I came back from the Navy.
It's Ford versus Ferrari versus Riley Hopkins.
Well, interestingly enough, I mean, I won the U.S. Championship in Formula Atlantics and got asked to design and build a track like the Long Beach Grand Prix here for Tacoma, which I did. But in the middle of this, we had an opportunity to race for Aston Martin. And Carroll Shelby's son, Patrick, was one of the guys that I raced with. And I thought it'd be really neat to have Patrick and I race this Aston Martin at the 24-hour race in Le Mans, which, you know, that's his dad won it, as you saw in Ford versus Ferrari. And anyway, I got in the car in Daytona, and everything was great. I mean, the steering wheel fit. I could throw opposite lock and not pull my shoulder off the seat. Mirrors were adjusted. Everything was wonderful. And I looked down, and there was a 3-inch aluminum fuel transfer tube from the right tank to the left tank. And they just butt welded some aircraft fittings on the end of it. And I immediately saw getting hit in the side, having 50 gallons of fuel in the cockpit with me. And me being a crispy critter. And I got up out of the car, and my wife was there with me, and she knew how much I wanted to race for Aston because of my background. And I got up and I said, well, I'm sorry, I just don't feel comfortable in this car, and started to walk away. And she wanted to know what the hell was the matter with me. And so I told her, and she goes, oh man, you got to go with your gut. And that car crashed at Le Mans in that race. Lost a tire after coming out of the pits. Thing went down at about 235 down the Mulsanne Strait. The centrifugal force kept the tire up until he got down to about 120, and then it went nuts. Went across the track, flew up into a tree, which got the side tank, completely filled the cockpit. Came back down on the track, came across, and the second Aston Martin hit him in the left tank.
And that was it?
Well, no. Unfortunately, the guy lived because he was a society dentist in London, and just horrible burns, you know, just. But you can imagine what I felt like having had that little thought balloon in the pits at Daytona, mm-hmm. and going, man, I'm glad I listened to myself.
Holy cow.
Yeah, a little different.
So,
yeah, so how does driving almost 200 miles an hour?
Let's talk screen printing. So most shops, we've got, you know, thousands of shops that listen to this podcast and watch it. Mm-hmm. Most of them know your name. You are a household name in our printing industry. Most people have started with a Riley Hopkins 4x4. So first of all, thank you for joining us.
Oh, yeah. It's really nice to be here. It's only taken about a year to track me down.
You are really hard. Bruce would call me. We've been talking. We'll talk about guests. And we're like, we want to get Riley on the podcast. We want to get. Can we talk about that a little bit?
Sure. I mean, you know.
It went on forever.
Well, when you're, you also say like, because you're in a couple different locations.
Yep.
And so Ryan Moore, who, thank you to Ryan for helping set this up, was like, okay, you gotta call him, but maybe try his wife, but don't text, but, you know.
Yeah.
And then if he's in Kansas, he's just like out there.
Well, it depends on how hard the wind blows, whether we get internet.
Right.
That's insane.
So, but we're persistent. And as Steven said, my first press was a Riley Hopkins, the half green, half blue,
right.
4x4. And so this was a really special opportunity, I think, just in the history of this industry. I mean, it's such an important piece that you've played that we really wanted to dive deeper on and learn more about. So with all that, you know, where did t-shirts and stuff fall into you driving 200 miles an hour around the tracks? Like, how did those connect?
Well, because I race, I'm always broke. So you're always trying to get to the next race. You got to sell ads. You got to do this, do that.
It's like bands.
It's like bands. Yeah. Music merch.
That's how Ryan got started building the screen printing stuff.
Sure.
You know, to help his business out. But anyway, it was always doing enough art to get to the next race. And I used to cartoon for about 38 weekly papers to get through school.
Wow.
And it's always, I've used art as a way of kind of getting to the next race. So I got a chance to be an art director for a few years for an agency that got bought out by a New York firm in San Francisco. They decided that that's where their creative center was going to be, was in San Francisco. And for that, I got to drive the agency's brand new Formula Atlantic car.
Nice.
So yeah,
good
okay,
party.
I'll do, I'll move. And I just, I was renting a pantry from my secretary while I was looking for a shop. And finally, after realizing how expensive it was to have a house or an apartment as well as a shop, I made a living loft in San Francisco. Mm-hmm. And a week after I got it, the guy that owned the agency says, well, hey, I got a new sponsor, Kimberly Clark. And I went, ah, great. And he goes, but feminine care products. And I wasn't going to be a very good spokesman. So I quit. And I, you know, I had this place and had a design studio, race car parlor, you name it, whatever would pay the rent and get me to the next race. And this guy from Texas came in and wanted me to design and build a four-color printer. You know, and I had screen printing experience, hand-cutting ruby lith and hand-registering screens before any of those machines existed. So I was aware of what you needed to do.
Because before that, it was just the table, like the pin system, right? Like,
well, if that.
Okay. You're literally picking up.
Yeah. You know, do four shirts and, you know, shoot yourself. But at any rate, I had no intention of being in a manufacturing business. But I built 12 machines total just to cover my design time.
And this was, he wanted the machines, not yes. the shirts. He wanted the machines to
right.
do
so he could print. What the reality was, and this fellow will remain nameless, he was going to print adult comic book characters out of Ron Turner's Last Gasp comics, which I used to race for, by the way. Anyway, he was living high off the hog for about 6 months with all this money that people were sending him for shirts, and he didn't have any way of producing the shirts. So about 6 months into this deal, he was starting to get a little desperate. So anyway, I built the first machine, but I built 12 to go with it. And I never expected those to sell.
What did that first machine look like for him? You said you could do up to, was it four colors or was it three colors?
No, it was four colors, single station.
But it was like side by side or rotating?
Yeah.
Okay.
So you could register, essentially.
Yeah, absolutely. And it, if you were to look at those first machines versus now, the common thread design-wise is the same. And the one thing that really hacked me off in racing, some guys would take a standard part that you could buy off the shelf and he'd modify it just enough to charge you 4 or 5 times what it was worth. And that hacked me off enough to the point where I vowed that I would never obsolete any machine, period. So that everything that I built in the future as an accessory would fit everything I ever built. And of course, all the business guys were saying that was really stupid because planned obsolescence is the way you make money.
Because then someone has to buy the new the new foundation of it.
Which used to really hack me off, you know, so that's not going to be me. And as it turns out, nowadays, that little swivel board you saw, that'll fit close to 50,000 machines.
Wow.
Which never would have happened if I'd done this planned obsolescence deal.
Wow. And I want to talk about that first 4x4. So what year was that you designed and built those in?
That was in the late 60s.
Was it one station? Or was
it single station.
Single station, but so that was in the late 60s.
Yep. Just at the start of the t-shirt craze in San Francisco.
And you couldn't find that machine.
Yeah. At the time, Vastex was just starting to do one, and there was a company named... They had some patents on hold downs, which had a hell of a time designing around it, because I don't like to violate somebody else's idea. But there was also a company called Richardson at that time from the Ohio. But they were difficult to get and difficult to use. So when I got done with this thing and he took the first press, the other 11 were gone the first week. I hadn't talked to anybody, nothing. Just people walking up to the front door, cash in hand.
How much would that press have sold for in the 60s?
It was under $1,000.
So at the time, that's probably what, $5,000 to $10,000 of?
Yeah, probably about five.
Yeah. And so how many car parts were on that first press? Like, I know there's bearings on there. Like, were you designing this from scratch, kind of similarly how you're showing us these schematics?
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah, we had to custom wind our own springs and everything else. And it was a major enterprise because, truth be known, when you look at how the press works, you got to engineer the springs backwards.
Interesting.
To get it so it clamps down.
So it'll hold up with the screen on it. When you throw it, centrifugal force wants the screen to flop down. So the spring's got to be strong enough in the up position to withstand that centrifugal force. Which is
the bottom
totally
flipping
backwards.
Around. And yeah, that's really interesting. So, okay, you design the first one. You sell a dozen of them. Did you start selling that press... And we're going to get to Ryan, but I know Ryan wasn't born in the 60s, so that will come at a certain point. Tell us the story of, 60s, 70s, 80s.
Where did they find it?
Yeah.
Where did other people find it?
Well, like I say, in the beginning, it was just word of mouth. And then there was
a
sheet.
Call you up, so you really
no, not even that. Just, you know me and phones. Anyway, they just walk up to the front door.
They'd literally walk up to your front door or your house.
No,
of your shop
in San Francisco.
So they're hearing, you've got this. He's at this address. Go down.
Yeah, no, we heard you got it. Give me one.
A little passcode to get in, or
yeah.
Well,
four
anyway,
by four?
I decided I'd go over to sheet metal presses, so I could handle greater numbers. And as soon as I started with the sheet metal, I found that it didn't fit quite right. And as soon as you bent it to get it to fit, the thing turned into linguine.
Hmm.
And it wasn't going to last the test of time.
It wouldn't hold registration. And I mean,
all of the above.
And that's why those things are built like tanks, right?
Yep. Precise, lightweight tanks.
Hmm.
So how many did you name it the Riley Hopkins at the time?
It was just, yeah, Hopkins screen printing machinery.
So how many?
I need a t-shirt like that.
That's Hopkins really cool.
Screen printing machinery.
How many do you think you sold up until Ryan got in the picture?
Oh, 40,000.
Wow.
What?
Yeah.
And that's all people just showing up at the door.
Oh, no, no. After that, got a dealer network and all that sort of thing. But
and you're make, okay, so scaling to make 40,000 of these, who's, how does that work?
Well, fortunately, I'd worked for Boeing for a while as an artist up in Seattle. Mm-hmm. And in addition to fine art, I also did an awful lot of scheduling graphics for that. And I was going, God, how am I going to schedule all this stuff? And I was like, wait a minute, I did this for about 4 years for Boeing, you know, so got my little dance card with flow charts of what timing had to be, and we're off to the races. I was pretty smart.
Were you manufacturing them all?
Yeah.
So your own staff, your own facility, yep. Your own CNC, like yeah, everything?
No, that was way before CNC.
Okay.
Wait, so you, is there a team?
Well, we had we started out with just me, and then I got one other guy. And then we eventually went to, we went up all the way to four people. And then I moved over to Berkeley for some unknown reason. And we had about 12 people there to begin with, topped out at 50. And I found that about a dozen people are comfortable. That's more a family deal. And you can sort stuff out quickly, and politics aren't quite as rampant as a big organization.
When did automatic screen printing start to creep? Like, did you start to get word of it? Like, tell us about the trend, like automatic printing presses.
Well, I used to do a lot of work with Winterland Production, Bill Graham's organization. And so they had manual equipment, as well as they started coming in with automatics. And of course, whoever they'd send out from Chicago to build up the press wouldn't do it right. And I'd always get a panic call in the middle of the night.
Was it a different color by any chance?
You mean the automatics?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, they were.
Gotcha. Not green. Not red, but maybe blue or something.
I don't really want to say.
Okay, gotcha. All right.
I don't like to talk down about other people's stuff.
We want to have legends on this podcast. You're one of the first. We would invite any other legends on this podcast as well. Very hard to get a hold of.
Yeah. Well, so, you know, the first one, I was a Chicago machine, and it had the print heads on the outside with a carousel in the middle. And guy goes, this thing won't register. And I said, well, cycle it. And every time he hit the thing, the outer print heads hadn't been stuck into the middle of the press. Nothing had been leveled. So every time he'd cycle it, this thing would give it one of those. You know, and he'd have registration from Mars. So I wound up rebuilding a couple of automatics. But frankly, I like to hire people and provide equipment that can support families as opposed to automatics.
Huh.
I know it's difficult to get qualified labor, but so what?
So you kind of thought, like, automatics are out there. I'm going to build the press, the hobbyist press for that, their first, you know. And that's really where, like, everyone started with the Riley Hopkins. And mm-hmm. That's kind of, you decided I'm going to stay in that niche.
Yeah, well, I made the decision early on. I didn't want to be responsible for some machine in Sri Lanka going down at $500 an hour and me trying to figure out who I was going to send to fix it. It just, that wasn't on.
That's interesting.
That's
a hard decision to make.
Yeah.
For someone that likes to go fast.
Well,
that's a.
But the reality is people's lives are dependent upon what you build. And if you don't give it the best you've got, then you're at fault in my book.
Were there any interesting iterations on the manual press? You talked about sheet metal wasn't going to be the right material to use. Were there any other things that, you know, over the years, especially through the 60s through, you know, before Reinette, that you kept changing or improving on?
Well, I always came up with new ideas. And my track record's been basically about 1 in 10 successes, which when you think about it, isn't bad. But the expense of that is horrific if you're a small company. You know, so I had a lot of inventory up on the shelf for stuff that was a great idea.
Can we stop that for, can we pause there? So you said your success rate was 1 in 10. So you would flop on an idea 9 times and one would hit. Yep. Can you share a couple of those? What were your biggest failures or misses?
Well,
the ones that really hurt.
Well, I mean, they all hurt because they came straight out of my wallet and a lot of time.
Sure.
But the reality is, if you look at any design that's come out, half of them are because of mistakes. When you screw something up, not only do you learn from it, but you also see the other way of how to do it, which you'd never see if you didn't screw it up in the first place. So I've never tried to discourage screw-ups unless they're repetitive ones, because you always learn something from it.
Wow.
But what were some of the ones where you're like, oh, this will take, this is it.
This is going to be the one.
Yeah. And then it did, turns out the market didn't want it.
Well, I did a numbering machine, which every time I'd build one, I'd jack the price about $1,000 or $2,000 because I really hated them. But these had a deal that went back and forth, and the pallet was 9 degrees.
Like a so flip-flop?
Yeah. Well, but it was this way.
Okay.
And you'd have two sets of numbers on each screen.
So you could do two color numbers, right?
Yeah. Well, two numbers.
Gotcha.
They were all white or whatever black color you were going to have. But also had the same deal for the sleeves. Mm-hmm. And all this linkage, this, that, and the other thing. So I figured I lost probably about $3,000 a machine. So after 6 of them, I quit it. And that was painful. But the other one that was difficult was a 74-inch diameter casting. So in other words, from over there to over here, it would take about a week and a half to cast the thing. And I had to buy a vertical lathe that was capable of turning a piece of metal this big around. And it cost more to ship the thing from the west side of San Francisco Bay to Berkeley than it cost for the machine, and the machine was expensive. So plenty of little whiz bangs that were good ideas, but enough that succeeded to not make me fearful of trying something new. And I've always led with my chin anyway, so.
Did you notice a turning point in your business where, you know, I mean, going to 40,000 presses sold over time, were there points in the trajectory of the business that, you know, maybe it was a marketing thing that helped take off, or maybe you started branding them differently, or?
Well, I had several managers over the years that tried to become me and claim all of the work that happened, started their own companies and that sort of stuff, which was a little painful, to say the least. That was one of the things, but I was trying to race at Indy 500. That was my goal, so I had to spend quite a bit of time away from the factory. My busiest year, for instance, between trade shows like this and races, we were gone 42 weeks out of 52, and that included racing down in New Zealand. And
so you were racing this whole time while building the business.
And did you race the Indy 500?
Unfortunately, no, I didn't. I raced here on Long Beach, which was great, a lot of fun. Finished sixth here in the Atlantic race. I won the U.S. championship for the city of Tacoma for their centennial. And the mayor threw this big party with the Chamber of Commerce when I got back. And he asked me if I could, while we're up at the podium, asked me if I could design and build a track like the Long Beach Grand Prix. Hmm. And like an idiot, I said, yeah, sure, no problem. And that was my Indy deal right there. gone.
Oh, because it took so much time.
Yeah, it did. We built a mile and a half track around the Tacoma Dome in Tacoma, ran it 2 years, had some really famous people help out. Bobby Unser was Grand Marshal the first year, and he helped me throughout the week. So,
wow.
A lot of stuff, but the side negative on it was it impacted the business.
Did Riley Hopkins as a company help you be able to follow your passion with cars and racing? Or was it, because I know you're passionate about the screen printing industry as well, but like at first it was just to get to the next race you're talking
right.
about. But I didn't know you're still racing like and doing all of this whole time as well.
Oh yeah.
So it wasn't like the, you know, it wasn't like Press Manufacturing took over and yet this took a total backseat, it sounds like. It sounds like this helped continue fueling.
Well, I started racing for other people and not doing my own stuff because I used to build my own race cars too. So just because I couldn't afford what I was racing against. But I started driving, I caught fire twice in a week, once at Elkhart Lake and once at Portland. And as a pretty famous car owner just said, hey, look, you don't need to keep doing this. Why don't you drive for me? So that really changed things. And that enabled me to concentrate on the business and just show up and drive the car.
I just really like, helped. I like the thought of running a growing business and being passionate about that, but also using it to fuel a passion and not, because it's easy to let other things fall off to the wayside because the business just constantly consumes more and more and more.
Yes,
right.
It does.
Like you could have stopped racing
right.
because this, you know, printing was more demanding or building that equipment, but like you made that a priority. Like my passion is racing. My business is selling equipment. That's really interesting.
Well, yeah, but have you ever had a chance to go sideways at 150 under control? I mean, that is prime time. You can't duplicate that anywhere. So
I bungee jumped once.
Today I went surfing with Bruce and I was sideways a lot in the water. It was really cold.
Some of my pals that printed this shirt up in Monterey, they're all surfers and skateboarders and stuff. They'll be down later on today. But, you know, they're out there with great white sharks. Give me a break.
Where did you and Ryan partnership come in?
Tell us about the inception. When did your eyes lock on Ryan Moore?
Was it the VHS tapes?
A young Ryan Moore. Tell us, on YouTube, Ryan's interviewed you. Now you get, we've known Ryan for years. So we're going to go through some great stories of Ryan, but we would love to hear it from your perspective. Well, if you could go back in time, tell us about that.
I crashed my old company and had to start from scratch.
Which one was that?
I don't want to get into it.
Okay.
I had some serious help in order to do that. But at any rate, I had, fortunately, having grown up in Japan, I've always thought cubically instead of square footage wise. So all my inventory was on big racks and wheels and stuff so I could get enough room to actually build stuff. And I built over 400 presses in a 22 by 24 foot garage with our 20 by 30 foot hospitality tent from the racing team. Where I would cut steel and weld and make crates and all that. And so anyway, Ryan and his wife showed up down the driveway one day and he's looking around like, what did I drive all this way for? Sort of thing. But
you just showed up to knock on the door?
Well, I mean, I knew he was coming.
Oh, okay.
But I didn't know what his thought process was.
How old was Ryan at this point?
I think it was like 27.
He only looks like he's like 30 right now,
but
hasn't aged. But okay, so Ryan, it's a 27-year-old.
Yeah, and he was running out of his bedroom.
Okay.
You know, they did this big rock and roll band, and I used to play bass guitar 1,000 years ago in old three-chord progression rock and roll band. So I've always had an affinity for the way they play, especially Brandon. Brandon's dad is a killer guitarist, but that's another story. Any rate, in my crash of the business, I lost about $4.5 million and my company in about 15 minutes, and I was still personally liable for about $1 million in personal loan guarantees. So obviously, me being me, I figured I had an advantage.
And this was separate business to...
This was my screen printing manufacturing business.
Wow.
Oh.
I'd made the mistake of licensing another company. So at any rate, came up with an extended registration system that I'd always wanted to implement. Came to the Long Beach show 3 weeks after I splattered myself. But at any rate, everybody thought I was supposed to be dead. And I just went on selling stuff right off the bat and kept going. So Ryan was the first guy to do anything with the internet. And I'd had all these brick and mortar deals. And the second that I had problems, everybody's vapor trails over the horizon trying to get away from me. So I just thought, well, you know, hell with you guys. You know, let's do something different. So here Ryan rolls in and goes, well, let's do this on the internet. I said, okay, no sales territories. Have a nice day. And we just absolutely killed it right then and there.
Wow. And it wasn't pretty quick.
Yeah. And it just, you know, I'd drive down halfway to Vancouver from Gig Harbor. We'd meet at a place to have some coffee and I'd unload a dozen machines and
he'd go back down.
Yeah. And I'd see him next week kind of thing. And that's how it started.
You know, like when a young person approaches you with like a new idea or something like that, like generational, my business partner's twice my age. He's manufacturing welded presses. Like he tells me a bunch of stories. He took me in when I was 22. He's 64 now. What was it like working with someone like that? You know, knowing that there's generational differences, you all have different talents. What was that like with Ryan early on?
Well, it was great because in the first place, it was new blood for openers. He was a really good musician, really good performer, very good communicator. And his video work was just nuts. It was just way too much fun.
Yeah.
You know, it just switched the game. Yeah. And everybody else is calling me up going, well, hey, can we see all your stuff? Sorry.
So he was doing all the tutorials using probably the Riley Hopkins press.
Well, he in high school, he had one of my yellow starting line presses. I just met a guy that he went to school with today, as a matter of fact. But anyway, that's what he learned on. And I told him early on that I was really concerned that he established three or four guys that were very good screen printers to be on staff so that anybody that called up that needed help in the middle of a job could talk to somebody that could help him. And I told him the importance of that, which he agreed with me, and he set it up that way. So there was always a life support system in the background.
Wow.
So, and my deal was just trying to make something that you couldn't possibly break it.
That's interesting.
Well, I didn't want it falling out of the sky.
Yeah.
Because like I had said earlier, people's lives depend on the equipment that you make. So it better be your best. Every one of them.
When did you let Ryan paint it green? Did he come one day and say, okay, I'm going to paint it bright green? Like,
no, actually I stole Rock's green at a trade show in Amsterdam.
Okay.
It was the first time I'd ever seen him. And I thought, they're from Portugal. They'll never get to the States, but they just had this great green.
Huh.
And so I thought I got to use that somehow. So that's what I did. And a lot of fluorescence. The green and blue one was when I first started it. Yeah. But Rock also had these really beautiful brushed aluminum extrusions that they used on their press too. That thing just looked great. My socks were rolling up and down so hard they almost caught fire. It was bad.
It's really interesting because like you come from cars and like building beautiful cars and like the craftsmanship and the durability, and then you put it into presses, and like Rock was sort of doing the same thing in Portugal. When Ryan started to bring Rock to the United States, did he talk to you about that at all? Like how was that relationship with all of you guys?
Yeah, we started with the green, you know, because I stole that green, you know, and that was the start of our conversation.
How do you
spend time today. I mean, you bring this along, which this is an insane project. Really cool. You showed us a swivel board.
Yep. So you're not done yet.
Yeah, I mean, you've got a nonprofit, which we'll talk about too, and how people can support, because that's really cool. But is it just like, I got to be building, I want to be doing things, or how?
Well, I like doing stuff that people can use, you know, and gain a benefit from it. You know, I've always liked this industry because every blank shirt is a canvas. And as an artist, I want to throw something on it. And there's no end to what you can put on there. So I've been a fan since day one.
What do you see about the industry now then, and where things are going? What do you think?
Well, you know, it's interesting. Everything sort of has its own cycles.
Okay.
And I remember I was dead broke in high school. And as I said, I was doing editorial cartoons and that sort of stuff. But I could not afford to compete against guys who were going down to the latest, greatest men's store. So I started putting my own stuff together. My grandfather gave me his late 1920s camel hair, collarless smoking jacket. And I'm going at this thing like, God, that thing's a million years old. I showed up at school, and about a month later, all of a sudden, collarless stuff was in vogue, and I was a trendsetter on no money. So anyway, long story short on that one, I got in my high school class, I got voted best dressed on no money. So to me, all things are possible if you're just willing to be a little strange at times and try something new.
Interesting. When you see the digital kind of transformation in printing, transfers, the DTGs, DTFs, what do you think about, knowing that you were like very early on in the screen printing industry, what do you think of it all?
Well, I think it's very usable technology, and so is screen printing.
Okay.
Screen printing gets you the possibility of doing stuff that you can't do with the other stuff. And you can't do the same thing as digital printing off of a screen printer. So each place has its own place and its economies of scale. Who can afford to get in business, come up with a good idea that people salute and want to buy, and you can scale that.
It's interesting because some people that have been around the block in screen printing will hate digital. Like, oh, the hand feels awful. Those transfers feel like plastic. And there's others that are more open to it.
Sure.
It sounds like you look at technology as like, you know, what's going to serve your cut? Like, what's your kind of, how do you look at new technology?
Where can I use it? You know, where can it benefit me? That's my view of it. I'm open to anything, but not at the expense of things that work. I'm not interested in just changing horses just to change horses. I still have allegiance to all the people that have purchased machinery over the years. They don't need to be obsoleted as long as they work.
That's interesting.
Are we going to see a Riley Hopkins heat press?
Oh, I did one for Nike way back when. I was talking to the fellow over at the Stampinator, which is a beautiful. Yeah, he's really done a nice job on that. But I did one in the mid 80s for Nike so they could print foil on one of my 8 colors. So it's a good process. Anything you can adapt to and create another function with, I'm in favor of. You know, as opposed to having to go out and buy, you know, some brand new.
It's like the mistake, like the failure, like the second iteration of a product might even be better than what it was intended to be built.
Yeah, absolutely. That's why it's, you know, I mean, you look at the Post-it, how did that happen? A mistake.
Huh.
Interesting. A few of those have been sold.
Interesting.
Okay, so tell us about your nonprofit in Salinas that you're using, and you're molding in screen printing, you're molding in car manufacturing. What is that about?
Well, actually, I have a coffee group with a bunch of guys in, there's like 5 of them in Carmel. One of them's a detective with the sheriff's department who knew this judge in Salinas who had started this vocational school. He got, you know, he was really tired of sentencing families three generations deep out of, because he was a Superior Court judge. And so he decided to start this vocational school. Didn't think it was going to take off or anything. And I was just talking to him earlier this week. And I said, you know, I really empathize with you, because I imagine when you did the first shovels for underground wiring here, to look at a $20 million facility and 200 students, you never envisioned it. He goes, no, I didn't. Yeah. And I said, well, that was the same thing with me and machinery. I never expected to do that. I didn't realize I'd just strapped myself to a rocket and lit myself off. Because, you know, I haven't stopped since then. And I never envisioned it to begin with. So he is the same way. So at any rate, my wife, Valerie, who you've actually been able to get a hold of, she was talking to this detective, and he told her about this school. And she goes, well, they need to start screen printing. Hmm. And we had some old stuff gathering dust in the garage. So I took a bunch of it out there and worked for a couple of weeks to marry everything into one roll-around package. And then we just demonstrated it last week for the first time.
Wow.
So they're starting a whole brand new curriculum around screen printing. So, which is great. Yeah, I mean, they hadn't planned it. We just showed up out of left field with some machinery.
So kids or adults can get, you know, on the job type training, or maybe not on the job, but just training of doing these other types of careers, starting a shop or.
Well, and, you know, at the end of the day, most of the students there have never, ever experienced anybody paying attention to them, much less thinking that they may have some ideas. They're always just a negative this or a negative that. And I heard a couple of the instructors say, well, this is their last chance. And I, you know, instantly took offense at it, because in actual fact, as far as I'm concerned, it's their first chance, because nobody's ever given them a chance.
It's just a different type of chance. Yeah.
Well, yeah. So it's actually a school of very, very valuable skills, because you can learn how to weld, you can learn how to be a mechanic, diesel mechanic, truck mechanic. And as I say, they're starting a new restoration division, which they're going to build a brand new building, paint booth, everything else for it. And we're going to plug it in with McPherson College in Kansas. So we'll be basically a prep school for them. They've got a pile of scholarship money available, so we can take top students, send them to McPherson.
And work on the best cars in the world. That's really cool.
Yeah, and you know, the car collector scenario worldwide is absolutely huge. And the thing that everybody needs is somebody who's qualified and knows what the hell they're doing. You know, how to go backwards in time on the car to see every iteration of it so that it's restored correctly. Rancho Cielo is in Salinas. That's the one that I'm working with. And I've donated screen printing machinery to McPherson as well, which is McPherson College in McPherson, Kansas. And if they're interested in finding out about McPherson, their president there is Amanda Gutierrez, who's a great person. And they're very closely affiliated with the Pebble Beach Concourse. And they're actually, Rancho Cielo is on their donation list. So if we can sell this car for $400,000 or $500,000 at auction, that'll go straight into Rancho.
Wow.
It's so cool.
Riley, I know, so a lot of shops that are listening to this, they do, you know, anywhere from a couple $100,000 a year to $5-10 million. They all have anywhere between no employees, they work out of their garage. Some have 20, 50, 100 employees.
Yep.
You have, you know, you have gone through a lot of life and business and passions. You've crashed and burned at different points, and you've gotten back up. What is the one consistent lesson or some kind of wisdom that you've always told yourself that could be something that someone listening to this might find useful?
Well, I think it's really important to stay nuts. That's the important thing. If you're not willing to do something that everybody else tells you won't work, if you're not willing to try that, you're in the wrong game. You know, it's the stuff out of left field that you never expect. All of a sudden, somebody salutes, and you're off to the races.
Amazing.
Riley Hopkins, are you still driving cars?
Yeah.
I mean, what? Racing cars?
Yeah. Actually, I'm looking for a sponsor for this fall. Need about $30,000 to race prep the car. Engine needs the performing of laying on of hands.
Maybe Rock could.
Well, actually, he and Ted Stahl sponsored me about 10 years ago.
Whoa. That's a legend. We want some Stahl's legends on the podcast.
Oh, man. That's the guy. That is the guy. We've been pals forever.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he's amazing.
Cool.
We burned down more bars in Europe than you could believe.
Ted Stahl's. You heard it first.
You heard it here.
Stahl's are great friends of the pod. They're great for our industry. What do you drive? What's your favorite car to drive right now? Or what's in your garage? I don't know. Tell us a little bit about it. We don't know anything about cars. Ours are electric. Sorry.
Yeah. So part of that trying to get to the next race thing. I have a 63 Ford Econoline pickup, the little shorty.
Okay.
Slab nose. So, of course, on Friday afternoon, I went to the wrecking yard, got the back section of another van, took it to my house in Seattle, cut my car in half, lengthened the wheelbase 3 feet so I could have an angled bed for hauling race cars, made my own drive shaft, and drove it to work on Monday. So I've got that rig that's got a V8 in it, and it hauls my Atlantic car or Formula Ford. It weighs about 2,000 pounds and has a V8 in it. So I was late for a trade show in Chicago with it and got a ticket up in Montana. The guy was generous. He only wrote me up for 140, and I had been doing about 100 and a half for about an hour. Anyway, fortunately, they didn't have speed limits during the daytime, so he gave me a $5 energy consumption ticket.
So, can you imagine you sit on the highway and you see Riley just blow past you going to Long Beach?
Oh, yeah. I mean, up in the mountains in the snow, always, whoever I was riding with, I'd wind up having to drive and try and find the sweet spot where the slides are just very nice, controllable. And that race car transporter, that wound up being 70. And if you put chains on it, you could not go faster than 30 miles an hour. But 70 was real nice. 75 was a little too much.
Just on the switchbacks?
65 is a little too slow. No, this is in a straight line.
Okay. Wow.
Yeah, that's crazy.
And for all of you folks out there that ever drive in the rain, the secret to that is you get a death grip on the steering wheel. So you got to wiggle your fingers. And the best way to drive in the rain is to use your thumb and index finger on both hands. And if you're sliding too much, take one hand off so you don't fight yourself.
That's this the way is to like do if it. You're going 100 miles an hour in the rain, or this is like
100 and a half.
Yeah. Yeah, I feel like I'm on the other side of like.
Are you a big F1 fan? Do you like watch all the.
Sort of.
Yeah. Is there a favorite team
like
you have?
I like IndyCars.
IndyCars?
A lot. Primarily because it's more competitive. The idea of having 150 engineers for a small team is a little nuts to me. It's okay. It's just not the same.
Yeah.
I like the stuff back when they had the Cosworth V8s and they used to race around here. You know, the cars were so evenly matched, you just had to drive the hell out of them. And it was a driver's sport. Now everything comes in via computer and the engineer tells you what they're going to change, not what you felt. And to me, that's sort of backwards. It works, but it takes the driver out of the picture.
Like a video game now a little bit.
Yeah. Well, and all the sims show you where the track is, and which works really, really well.
Riley Hopkins, the legend.
More adventure.
Thank you so much for being able to do this with us.
Well, we appreciate it.
Thank you. You know, I think you set the world's indoor record for trying to get a hold of somebody.
We're persistent.
Right.
We're a little nuts.
Well, but that's the thing that works.
Pronouncers, we appreciate you guys joining us. We're so glad we could do this at Long Beach. At, I don't know, shutdown TGI Fridays looking place. Thank you, guys. We'll see you guys in the next episode next week. Have a good one. Bye. Thanks so much for listening. Hopefully that was informative. Don't forget to subscribe. Don't forget to like. Don't forget to hit the bell for notifications if you enjoyed this video. If you enjoy all the stuff we're putting out, it's really helpful. We love to just be able to see it. That means that we're doing a good job. To subscribe, hit the bell for notifications, and hit the like button. And I'll see you in the next episode. Bye.